Stafford Marcy has been telling us for a long, long time that the world is changing, that financial controls and monetary systems are changing. He's told the business community to read the Bitcoin standard, the fiat standard, all of these reference works that will give you an insight into the way the world will be in the future. He's been a big investor in Bitcoin for, well, more than half a dozen years. And we're going to talk to him today about lots that's going on in the financial fields and why. Stafford, thanks for your time. Maybe just by way of background, your background. I know you studied computer science, might feel like a lifetime ago, in Tel Aviv and then worked in the United States. What drew you into this field and got you to continue with your lifelong learning? Because it's a field that is evolving so rapidly.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I came back and I worked for Telkom, and I think we mentioned this yesterday in the interview, I've been very privileged in my career because I've, from a technological perspective, had bumps in with big tectonic changes like this probably three or four times in my career. You know, when I was at Telkom, we saw the internet spawning before it had a browser, before it had an interface. And we recognized how big that was going to be. And we were running around telling everyone how big the internet was going to be. And we had scoffers. I remember there was actually a competition in Telkom where, I think it was the Telkom competition, where we sent an email with an attachment and somebody took that same email, printed it on a pigeon, printed it on a piece of paper, put it on a pigeon's leg and let it go from Telkom in Pretoria. And the pigeon got to the person in Durban before the email got to the person in Durban. And, you know, that was, so people would scoff. And that's the dilemma of being very deep, kind of under the covers on a technological basis, is coming up and explaining to the world what's happening, because the world's busy with all these other things that are going on. So, you know, seeing the internet and how big it was going to be, it was screaming and shouting. And then finally it was. And then I had, you know, I was living in the United States working for Novell in Utah. And then, lo and behold, this open source software thing came along. I mean, this is software written by people for free. Of like, why would people buy software by kids, right? You know, this is something that we couldn't understand. Even us as Novell at that time couldn't really comprehend. It took a while. You know, we were this multi-billion dollar enterprise selling proprietary software written by our engineers with peace of mind that we gave clients. And then people on the outside were writing things for free, and all they wanted was recognition. So their comments in the code or their names in the code. And that was it. That was all. And we knew that that was going to be big. And we had to turn Novell around, and Novell finally turned around. But that was my, and today everything runs on open source software pretty much. You know, and that software written freely by everyone. And then the third instance in my career was when, you know, I was in a startup that was building technology for banks. And not just simple technology, I mean, really deep, deep technology where we had to process a card transaction from a device that we had invented over a phone into a banking fabric, connecting to bank systems and doing interbank switching and transacting of the messaging systems, etc. This very, very complicated way. And along came someone and showed me Bitcoin. And this was way too simple for me. And I scoffed at it. I looked at it and I said, no, wait. And then fast forward to today. You know, and I've been an advocate for it since the penny finally dropped, I think from 3-4 years ago when you and I started talking about it. And then I presented at the BizNews conference. I'll never forget it at the first one I presented at. You know, you had some of these top analytical economic minds. And it's difficult because if you take a look at Bitcoin today, it represents 0.2% of the economy in the world. If this $900 trillion economy, it owns 0.0. When I started talking about it at business con, it was less than zero. It was like 0.05% of the economy. And when you have 0.05% of the economy being true hard money, it's very difficult to go to the 99.9% and tell them that, wait a minute, everything that you've been programmed by, all that fiat currency, that economic mindset that you've been enveloped in for years and your parents were, was all a lie. It's like, it's a lie. It's not the truth. And inflation works this way. And this is what central banking actually does. And that the entire global monetary framework is not in our favor. And we're enslaved by it. and that there's this true, true asset, like this real hard money. It's very hard for people to comprehend that, especially when someone is an economist. I mean, you've got everyone. You've got the Shapiros all the way through to whoever on stage over there, and they just couldn't comprehend this. And the problem with Bitcoin is it's surrounded by all these other like sparkly things called altcoins, and NFTs came along, and it makes noise around Bitcoin. And that confuses things a little bit. But if you just focus on that, and that's why I've been very adamant for the business community to do the homework. You know, don't go buy Bitcoin. This conversation, if anything from this conversation, if you've never bought Bitcoin, don't go buy Bitcoin. Go read about Bitcoin. Go understand Bitcoin. Listen to the podcast. Do 1,000 hours of research personally before you buy one single Satoshi, which is a decimal of a Bitcoin. Don't do that. Do the work. And that's why we've been adamant, even at the conferences, like the Bitcoin Standard, Lynn Aldman's book called Broken Money. And so what Bitcoin is doing, which is very, very interesting, is its revolution is the fact that it's teaching people on the ground what money is and where money comes from and the history of money. And we've never done that before. You know, 10 years ago, we didn't really think about money, except that this was the domain of the few. And today, you've got hundreds of thousands and millions of people thinking about money and the history of money and educating themselves around what is going on around them. And I think that's what the revolution is. And what's amazing to me, which is so beautiful, it's not dissimilar from the internet. You know, the internet was these thin protocols that popped up, like HTTP and HTML and TCP/IP. And those thin protocols built by hackers allowed us to communicate. And anyone in the world could put up a website and put up a blog and share their views, etc. And before corporations caught on to it. Not dissimilar as Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the first financial asset in the world where you and I could have bought it before a country can buy it, before an institution can buy it, because the regulatory frameworks have only really started maturing over the last year. I mean, ETFs coming along. Before ETFs, how could Microsoft buy Bitcoin? How could Apple buy Bitcoin? How could they put it on their balance sheets without fair accounting rules or FASB rules? It's incredible, but you and I can buy it. That's extraordinary that you and I can buy something that a corporation that is so big, a $1 trillion corporation, can't buy. And that is profound. Now, that profoundness is what unsettles economists because they just don't get it. And then the man in the street, just their broker, their advisor, can't get their heads wrapped around it. But I saw an FT article today, Financial Times article, and for the first time, the FT had an article acknowledging that Bitcoin should be considered, that it's here, it's real, and it's not going to go away, etc. That was the first time ever that I saw a positive Bitcoin article in the FT. So it's very, very interesting to see how things are eclipsing and the world is starting to catch up to where a lot of us, call us hackers, you know, started looking at this thing. But the problem with Bitcoin is it's not money. It's psychology. It's energy. It's physics. It's human history. It's anthropology. It's chemistry. It's this, like, if to understand Bitcoin, it's not the coin go up, coin go down. And that's very frustrating too, because there's so much more to this protocol and the proof of work protocol. And essentially, this is a protocol that allows Bitcoin to autonomously execute from a transaction perspective in the background on nodes with miners, and it connects it to energy in this unique way. And a lot of people broke away from it because they thought its energy consumption was not proper. It's like it's too much. But that link to energy gave it its beauty. And that's what we're seeing in the world today. It's energy consumption and what it's doing in the energy realm is, for me, even more interesting than, is it going to go up or is it going to go down? Is it a treasury reserve asset for the United States? And, you know, all of that noise. At the end of the day, for me, the back-end protocol, it's just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen as a technologist, ever. I don't think we've ever seen anything as beautiful as that Bitcoin white paper, ever. I don't think I've read anything simpler and more powerful. Yeah.
Who wrote that white paper? Do you think it was a group of people who did it, if it was that beautiful, or was it some super genius? Some people say Elon Musk wrote it.
No, definitely not him, right? But, I mean, he was doing other stuff when this was happening. No, definitely, we don't know. We don't know if it's an individual. Is it Halfini, this guy that perhaps is that? Is it a group of people? But that's the beauty of it, right? It doesn't really matter. And whoever that is, I believe, is gone. Because there's no way that amount of power, any human being, I mean, that person would own 1.1 million Bitcoins. It's very hard to keep yourself in the background. So no, I think that individual, those individuals are no longer relevant. It's independent. And that's what makes it so beautiful. It's decentralized. It's immutable. It's sovereign. And it frees us up from this monetary system that's inflation, central bank based. And that's its beauty.
Stafford, if you think back through the eons, at some point in time, someone said, gold, this shiny yellow thing that is hard to find, that you can't, it's not lying around the place. At some point in time, somebody felt there was it got scale. There were enough people who said, okay, gold, as Vikings, we're going to go and plunder the nearby lands to get their gold. Has that scale of people, in other words, the tipping point for Bitcoin, has that arrived? And if it has, how long has it arrived or been with us for?
Well, let me answer the former part of that question first. Has it arrived? Well, look at the IBIT performance, right? And that's the BlackRock ETF. That's the first institutional platform for acquiring this asset. So you don't really buy Bitcoin because, you know, the way we buy Bitcoin, we own it and we take it off exchanges. We have it on these little sticks and we have key phrases. But a corporation can't do that. Like a board, who owns the Bitcoin keys? Who owns the passphrases? Those are all difficult things. So, but like I said, corporations can't own it. So now we have ETFs. If you just take a look at BlackRock issued those ETFs, I mean, look at the numbers. A $40 billion ETF in less than a year. In 211 days, the inflows, $40 billion inflows into that ETFs. We've never seen an ETF performance like that in the history of ETFs. So nothing like it. I mean, it's outperformed the last 10 years of ETFs that were issued. So has it arrived? I believe it has arrived. I think you're going to see more enterprises putting it on their balance sheet. You see MicroStrategy, and it's part of your portfolio and the business community's portfolio. That's exactly what you're going to see. You are going to see corporations that have a core business. They're going to have a Bitcoin reserve, and they're going to trade and utilize that as the hard money relative to the organization. And I think they're going to do what MicroStrategy is doing. I think you're going to see more and more business doing this. I think you're going to see the FASB rules finally being adopted, the free accounting rules, which means you don't get punished for having Bitcoin on your balance sheet. You know, before the FASB rules, the free accounting rules, when Bitcoin went down, you got a hit, but when it went up, you didn't get the value. With free accounting rules being applied to it, now the asset is measured fairly and it doesn't hurt you. I think that changes the game. That gets enterprises to step further into it. So not only the ability from a financial accounting perspective to give account for the asset, but also utilizing this asset with financial instrumentation the way MicroStrategy has. It's very interesting, and businesses are starting to do that. You see Bitcoin miners out there deciding that they're not going to sell their Bitcoin anymore. They're going to use their Bitcoin as reserve assets. And now you see countries doing it. You know, the Kingdom of Bhutan owns $1 billion. They've made $1 billion from their Bitcoin that they've mined through hydroelectric electricity in their country. You see El Salvador, you know, sitting with over $500 million worth of it now and more able now to pay off their IMF loan. And you're going to see more and more of this. But I think the big one that we're looking for right now is what the United States will do. We've seen RFK, we've seen Donald Trump, we've seen, you know, senators, and you know, we've seen state level movement where everyone is saying that the United States should buy another, besides its confiscated Bitcoin, it should buy another $5 billion worth of Bitcoin over the next 4 years and use that as a strategic reserve asset.
Stafford. Yeah. The confiscated Bitcoin. What exactly is that?
Well, that's Bitcoin that people used according to the FBI for illicit means, right? They either held it illegally or they traded their company, did something bad, and they confiscated that Bitcoin. It's not necessarily that Bitcoin was used to buy cocaine, not anything like that. These are businesses that may have held it illegally and did something to hurt investors. So they'd confiscate that Bitcoin. So that's happened over the years. And that reserve is built and built and built. And I think the United States sits with over 250,000 Bitcoins, something like that. That's the number. So that's a huge amount of Bitcoin. So the question is, what are they going to do with that confiscated Bitcoin? Now they're getting, you know, for the most powerful man in the world to go to a Bitcoin conference, to say the things that he's saying about Bitcoin. For me, you know what hit me in Bitcoin, which was really, it's still, for us, it's jaw-dropping for us. You know, when Larry Fink went from, and the CEO of BlackRock, he went from, this is complete, he was echoing Warren Buffett's rat poison stuff, to saying something about blockchains, and then all the way to Larry Fink becoming pretty much the chief marketing officer for Bitcoin today. I mean, when he gets on shows, to see him say the things that he says, to hear what's coming out of BlackRock is still jaw-dropping for us. I mean, we just can't believe it. And now the United States president, you know, is backing this asset. He understands this asset. He speaks about this asset. He claims that he wants the United States to be where all the Bitcoin action happens, where all the Bitcoin mining occurs. He wants to have the biggest, this is where everything, all the innovation associated with that. Those are all signals that's moving the market right now. Because if he does move that confiscated Bitcoin into the Federal Reserve domain, and it becomes part of its portfolio, you know, it owns different currencies, the Federal Reserve, and this is one of the hard assets in there, and that helps to balance the $34 trillion book. This is very interesting. You know, if they decide they're going to do that and they're going to buy another, you know, $5 billion worth of Bitcoin over a period of time, I think that creates a run. I think other nation states will do it. I mean, nation states fight over hard assets. They fight over gold. They fight over oil. And why? Because those things are predictably hard. We know, I mean, we can only mine X amount of gold. We know how much we can get per year, and that's been constant since we discovered it. You know, so even though the technology has improved in terms of extracting gold out of the earth, there's only been X percentage that we can take out, that leak that occurs every year. And that consistency gave gold its beauty. It's rare. It's a hard asset. It may not have a fixed supply, but in terms of the leakage, the fixed availability of when we mine it, that was kind of fixed. And that predictability gave it enormous value. So we could, you could back it, you know.
Uh-huh.
Stafford, there were periods in the world's history where all currencies were backed by gold. That stopped them from being inflationary. Is there a case to be made to say that fiat currencies will be backed by Bitcoin at some point?
We believe that. We've been saying that for ages. I mean, if you don't, what do you back it by? You know, so like everything in the fiat world's a lie. I mean, it's all feeling. In 1971, when Nixon pronounced the divorce of the dollar from gold, the gold standard, and it went onto this other standard that was esoterical and you know, political certainty and military might and central bank power. And, you know, those things are, that's slavery. It's economic slavery. It's been lies. I mean, inflation is slavery. If inflation, no, if you take a look at all of that, this is finally an asset that comes along that gives us a benchmark and a global monetary framework perspective. It gives the world a substrate of true money, of truth. It is not feeling. It is not nation state power. It is not political beliefs. What it is math, science, physics, and energy. I mean, that it's better than gold. Why? Because who wants to? I mean, if you took a bar of gold right now, Alec, and you went to the airport and tried to go through check-in with a bar of gold, they're going to take it away from you. If you go with 250,000 rand in a little kit bag and you try to go, they're going to take it away from you. Right? Those are things that are confiscatory. They can take those things away. You don't own the money that you own. You don't own the gold that you own. You know, it's completely under the domain of the fiat system. Bitcoin is yours, and you can share it instantaneously with anyone in the world, irrespective of an intermediary. This is power that's very difficult to comprehend, but it's here, and the common man understands it, and institutions need to get their heads wrapped around it.
So if it's like any asset, I guess, or any esoteric asset, if people enough people believe that it has value, then it has value. That's gold. If enough people believe that gold had value, there we go. And at some point in time, you'll be prepared to pay $2,500 for an ounce.
Yeah, that's market.
You're saying
that's market
enough
dynamics,
people,
right?
Enough people today believe that Bitcoin has value. And if we take it to the next step, if you take the next step, which would be when governments start embracing it, and perhaps in an effort to address inflation, link it in some way to their fiat currencies, would that require a substantial revaluation of the Bitcoin price in the same way as if all currencies, if all countries went back on the gold standard? There wouldn't be enough gold, certainly not at the current level, price level, to go around. Is there enough Bitcoin to go around? And indeed, if something as radical as that happened, and if Donald Trump has told us one thing, he's prepared to do radical stuff, what would Bitcoin theoretically get to then?
Well, if gold is 16 trillion and we ate gold, which I think we're totally going to do, then Bitcoin sits between 700,000 and 800,000 a coin. You know, that's just if it goes off the gold alone. But remember, the 900 trillion market opportunity is made up of collectibles, gold, commercial, you know, real estate, other metals. I mean, if you really look at that 9 trillion. So I think we'll take a bit from commercial real estate. We'll take from general real estate. We'll take a little bit from the metals. We'll take a little bit of that. And people will diversify into this. And I keep saying that if we just took a 5% allocation, because right now allocation in the world is 0.2%. That's it, 0.2%. So if we went to 5% allocation, then Bitcoin sits higher than that.
So how do you change your mindset? We are human beings. We battle to think exponentially. If you're telling a 10-year-old about this, about what his parents have been taught and what his parents should actually be thinking of today because of the changes that you envisage, the internet being an example, cloud computing being another example. No one could have conceived in the early days of what was going to happen. How would you explain that, the future of Bitcoin, to that 10-year-old so that he can go and explain it to his parents?
You know what's interesting is that they get it. They just get it. They get it. The problem that you and I have, and the reason we struggle, is because we skeuomorphic about it. You know, it's like when the car was first invented, we put stirrups on it versus putting a steering wheel on it because we came from horses. You know, so that skeuomorphism drives us all the time. It's our context. It's what we've been programmed. It's when I matriculated, you know, what did I get? I got a little bank card and I got taught how an ATM works. And there was the bank. You know, if you take a fast forward to today, my kids, my 24-year-old and my 21-year-old, don't believe in banks. They think banks are a joke. Their money that they look at is ridiculous. They are completely disintermediated economically speaking. Why? Because we have programmed the fitness function of our economics to, you know, benefit people our age, Alec. I mean, my kids can't afford a house. This is the poorest generation in terms of affordability that we've ever seen. Why? Because everything that we do is, it's austerity measures that benefit corporations and the wealthy. And so we've completely disintermediated a complete generation. So they get Bitcoin before you and I get it. And then for me, my 24-year-old, 21-year-old, and my 8-year-old get Bitcoin, probably better than anyone in the business community. They own it. They love it. They love how you can play with it. They love the freedom of it. They love the accessibility that it gives them. The fact that they can transfer value independent of... They get that. The problem that we have is that we come with all of this fiat currency history and legacy. And then through that lens, we try to comprehend this asset. And it is, look, I've said it on stage at the business conference, you know, fire the wheel, Bitcoin. And people laughed at that. But they didn't truly comprehend that because people don't look deep into it. So for a 10-year-old, it's, what if I gave you something that no government could take away from you, that couldn't be debased by currency debasement, couldn't be deflated by currency debasement, inflation wouldn't affect it, that everything around it would get cheaper the longer you held it, and you could hold it for the rest of your life and for your children's lives and your grandchildren's lives for 100, 200 years, and it is the only place... Look at it this way. Let me answer you differently. Where would you tell a 10-year-old to put his fiat money today for the next 20 to 30 years? Besides the market. You could probably say buy an ETF of some kind and sit on it. We know the market generally goes up. But I mean, outside of the market, where would you tell that kid to put his money? Where?
In property?
Property is a burden. You know, kids today don't want, the benefits of access far surpasses the burden of ownership for them. They don't want to own things. They want to own cars. They want access to Uber as transportation. They want to own a house. They want Airbnb because it's, you know, for them, accommodation is a service. They don't want to own music like you and I did. They want to own access to music. I think this is not dissimilar to the way they want their money to work. Their money must be able to go anywhere that they are. Their money needs to act like the email acts. When they send a friend an email, it, no matter where the friend is, the mail gets there. Why doesn't money work that way? Why do we have a bank and a bank and an interswitch and a bank? It's way too complicated. I mean, if you had to send 1,000 rand to Namibia today, it's going to cost you 800 rand to send 1,000 rand. The system's broken. Why does it work this way? There's absolutely no reason for it.
But what about with your other hat on? You're on the board of Discovery Bank. So you're seeing
Not anymore. Yeah. Since a few weeks ago.
Did you talk too much about Bitcoin and they said no more?
No, not at all. I'd served there for just over 3 years. It was my time. I'm doing a project that may be a conflict of interest if I sit on the board of a bank. That's the real reason behind it. So it's my last project and it's a Bitcoin mining project and I can't really talk much about it, but I needed to spend more time on that. Let's put that board hat on. So go ahead, ask the question. I'll put that. It's easy for me to wear that hat.
Okay. So you are now on the Discovery Bank board as you were until a few weeks ago. You're having a conversation there about strategy into the future. What's your input into that board?
Well, number one is let's make sure that the South African regulator understands the demand of the consumer, first of all. The problem with in South Africa, and I'm not going to speak as Discovery Bank, I'll speak more neutrally because I think, you know, it's I know things and I, you know, still, and it's very fresh. So I don't think it's right. I'm probably under the NDA. So let's talk broadly about the banks in South Africa. Banks in South Africa want to hold crypto assets. They do. Problem is they're not allowed to. So they want to be custodians for this asset. The problem is that the Prudential Authority, the Reserve Bank, have no mechanisms to allow banks to do that and hold them accountable. Because again, at the end of the day, the Prudential Authority walks into a bank and audits a bank and says, where's the money? Where's the systems underlying the money? And are you behaving properly? And here's the big, you know, whatever laws that may be, from King on the board all the way to Basel, through, you know, all the banking laws. And they apply that framework. The problem that they have right now is they don't have a framework for Bitcoin. So if a bank wanted to hold Bitcoin, it's difficult. You know, how does the PA manage them? How do they report on that? How do they declare it? This is very, very difficult. But the need is there. The demand is significant. So what we need in South Africa right now is to spend a lot more time with regulators. And that's one of the reasons I also climbed off the board, because I want to do a lot of that. And I am engaging with various entities and stakeholders in the country to educate them about this asset. And a lot of the times you have to do it behind closed doors because it doesn't embarrass some people. People don't want to ask the simple questions that make them look simplistic, etc. And we need to do that work. And that work's happening right now. So from all the elements in and around the Reserve Bank need to get their heads wrapped around Bitcoin. How do we enable banks to become custodians of this asset? How do we hold them responsible so we don't have an FTX in South Africa where, you know, Adrian Gore holds some Bitcoin and then he trades it for something else and then declares something else outward here and then we catch him out? How do we make sure that that doesn't happen to us? So a lot of the maturing that's happening in the world, FASB, ETFs, you know, we've got, you know, Treasury Reserve asset stuff being, all of this starts great. It starts to create the language that allows enterprises, specifically banks, to hold this asset. It's very difficult for them right now. But I believe inevitably they will, because people are lazy. People don't want to, as much as we as Bitcoiners love the kind of the cyberpunk aspect of holding your money and owning your money and off a ledger and it's in your pocket and it's not in an exchange. You know, Alec doesn't want to do that. Alec doesn't want to run around with a USB stick somewhere or hold a passphrase or, you know, 12 words. You don't want to do that. You want your bank to own because you trust your bank. It's where your assets are. So I think banks will inevitably hold this asset. Now, the big question is, besides being custodians of this, will banks start utilizing this as something on their balance sheets to uphold their balance sheets? I think so. I absolutely believe that is a massive opportunity laying ahead for them. Yep.
So we buy the story. Those people who've been listening to you over years finally say, okay, I get it. Thank you very much, Stafford. At last, Elon Musk has obviously spoken something into Donald Trump's head. He's the most powerful guy in the world. He's a Bitcoin bro. Away they go. Where do you start participating in this asset class?
I think it's simple. I mean, if you want to, first for me, where do you start? Read. So there's books like The Bitcoin Standard. There are podcasts all over the place. Go listen.
No. People don't want to read. You know that. People don't read. They just want to do. So they say, you know what? Stafford, I trust you. Yeah. I trust you. I trust you. Where do I start? What ETF do I buy? What share do I buy? What investment do I make? Just to get my feet wet as a starting point while I'm busy reading.
So, you know, the easiest way is to go to an exchange like Valour or Luno. Those are the two big exchanges in South Africa. Link it to your bank account. Go through the whole KYC process. You know, so we're not avoiding tax and doing all the funny things. And you transfer some money from your bank account into the exchange's wallet. And you open up their application once you've gone through their enrollment. And you go and take a look at Bitcoin and you go buy Bitcoin. Now, fortunately, there are all these other crypto assets that they have. So you can go buy Doge, you can buy Solana, you can buy Purple Coin, Pink Coins, etc. My recommendation to investors out there, is ignore everything else but Bitcoin. Now, you get fascinated by the growth in Doge and Ripple and a lot of noise. I always give the advice, focus on Bitcoin. Focus, because every single one of those are copies of Bitcoin. And they may have a value proposition in time, but we don't know. And they move and their volatility has no underpinning. That's not a store of value, right? Because, you know, Ripple, a bunch of those guys could do something and your money could be gone tomorrow. You know, ETH, Vitalik BitTorrent does something, your money could be gone tomorrow. But Bitcoin is immutable, sovereign, etc. So stick to Bitcoin. Focus on it. Understand it first. Put your money in there. Watch it. Take your money off it. So as Bitcoin grows or goes up, see how do you get your money off an exchange? How do you sell it? What are the various mechanisms for selling it? You know, and play around with that and just see. And that's the recommendation I've given to the business community. And a lot of people have gone to Luno, they've gone to Valour, opened up their wallets and started playing. And it's incredible to see. It does get you hooked, but, you know, be careful because it's easy, it's enticing, and you can get distracted very, very quickly. But everyone seems to go through this transition where they go into Bitcoin, they understand the fundamentals, and then they get attracted by these sparkly things, these altcoins. They go and buy it and they play around with it. For me, here's my investment thesis. Bitcoin is where you put your money in for 5 years or more. I believe it's the safest asset class in the world. Everything else is trading. If you want to trade these other Web3 token things, go ahead and play with that stuff. But Bitcoin is the store value. That's where you put your money for multiple years from now on. Just on a philosophical basis, Alec, is, you know, for me, something is happening in the world right now, something really big. And it's been happening for a while, but we can start framing it at the moment. And the two big things happening is AI and, you know, artificial intelligence. And the other one is this Bitcoin thing. And people are starting to get their heads wrapped around it. And what's very interesting about these two things is that AI is doing to humanity in principle what Bitcoin promises to do for humanity too, right? Bitcoin gives us this hard asset. It allows the man on the street to participate in this network, this beautiful, sovereign, immutable thing, and free him up from the fiat slavery, right? I look at AI, and artificial intelligence is going to do the work that we can measure in efficiency and productivity. We're all worried about our jobs. But AI is going to free us up from the menial labor. We're in the year 1900 again, and we in with our oxen in the fields, and you know, combustion engines and electricity and all these things are happening around us, and it's going to free up our children, put them into high schools, and give them greater skills so we don't have to be plowing fields, the majority of us, right? We should be thinking about recipes and Michelin chefs and master chef programs. We should, as humanity, as being the substrate for our freedom, is laying more at our feet at the moment. One is to free us up economically and give us economic freedom that we've we don't know, and we've never had when we look back at our parents and our grandparents. Number one. Number two is we've got AI, and AI feels like this thing that's going to free us up from doing the work that we don't actually enjoy. There's too many people doing things economically with their time and energy that they shouldn't be doing. A machine should be doing it. And I think AI is going to free us up to do the things that we love, the things that are meaningful, and those things will have economic value in the future. Just like if we fast forward to go back to 1900, and we tell a person plowing with his oxen and these kids are in the field, if we said, hey, I want to tell you about a yoga instructor or like a wellness expert, they'd tell you, go away, right? There was no value back then. And I think AI is going to free us up from what we're doing today and create new economic value. And I think this combination of these two things coming, and they're coming together. And when that coming together happens, I think something beautiful lays ahead. Something really, really beautiful. Something beautiful from an economic perspective, and something where somebody can take their time and energy and apply it to something that they love and get economic, sustainable truth wrapped around that. I think this is a beautiful time. I've never been more excited about the promise of what this article today brings to mankind as I am today.
So the one element, Bitcoin, we know what to do there. Go and put R1,000 a month, R10,000 a month, whatever you can afford into a Valor or Luna account. Got that. With AI, how do you participate in AI? And don't say go and read about it, because unfortunately, Stafford, only 100,000 books a year are sold in South Africa. It's 100,000 people read in South Africa a year. It can't be 100,000 books because there's lots of secondhand books. But how do you start understanding? Do you get yourself a ChatGPT account at $20 a month and ask it what you would have asked Google in the past, or any other ideas that you can give us practically?
I think that's exactly it. I think your kids are doing it already. If you have a kid in university or kid in school, they're using ChatGPT, or they're using Claude, or they're using Perplexity. I mean, there's a lot of these, you know, these AIs, they're using it already. So it's being used. And it's a very interesting technology. I remember speaking to some of the leadership at Discovery not too long ago about this, saying it's quite a phenomena because, you know, usually technology enters the enterprise first, right? And then it kind of cascades down and outward, i.e. in the 90s, you went home with a pager that you got from the company, and the company gave you a pager, and it fascinated everyone. You fast forward a little bit more, the company gave you a tower, disk, a mouse, a keyboard, and a big fat modem that screamed when it connected to take home. You know, those are things that weren't affordable to the man on the street unless you were wealthy. But generally speaking, technology entered the home through the enterprise. This is the first time that I'm seeing something so significant, so impactful, happening on the edges of an enterprise. What we see happening in enterprises today is people are coming into the workplace, augmented by disparate species of artificial cognitions already. They're already doing things with it. So enterprises are struggling with this because, you know, IP leakage. You know, this thing does hallucinate. So what are the risks associated with that? What are the cybersecurity risks? There's a lot of this. So what should people do? Leaders need to understand that on the outside, people are doing it already. They're doing it. And so it's about embracing it, understanding it. Now, you know, if you had to take a look at it from an enterprise perspective, the problem with artificial intelligence is it requires a lot of compute, processing power. And unfortunately, that's been concentrated in the world today. You know, you've got NVIDIA, and around NVIDIA is probably 6 or 7 companies buying 80% of what it makes, 90% of what it makes. You know, that's Microsoft, OpenAI, that's Google, that's Anthropic, Amazon, etc. The Magnificent Seven revolves around NVIDIA all the time. So we do see a compute concentration with AI. So can you go off and create your own large language model, your own AI? Yes, you can. The problem is the compute. It's difficult to get from a supply perspective. It's very expensive. But these big AIs do allow you to create derivatives. There is open source LLMs, large language models, that you can go download. But the problem is the compute and how to build that up. So I think, you know, what's my advice to the individual? Keep doing what you're doing. It's made for you, and you've never... I mean, how the world is not going to change when every human being will soon have an Einstein that is eternally patient, that knows everything about anything, augmenting them. It's an extraordinary thing, this latent human potential unlock that's about to happen. I mean, we know the next 1 billion people to be connected to the internet is in Africa. But the beauty of that connection now is not that they're going to get connected to just information on the internet. They're going to get connected to AIs. And I think that human-machine symbiosis is going to create something really, really beautiful. You know, imagine Starlink. You know, today Starlink is a big issue, you know, in South Africa. We know why it's an issue. It's we've got operators here that don't want to see Starlink go live. Let's be honest. I mean, that's the reason Starlink is not live in South Africa today. The economic interest around it going live is crazy. But Starlink today is a dish that you can connect to a low-orbit satellite, Elon Musk's low-orbit satellite, and it can give you up to, you know, 600 megabits per second. Imagine going from nothing to 600 megabits per second on your phone. And you don't, and in the next few months, perhaps just 24 months or 36 months, Starlink won't require a dish. It'll be part of your phone. Most phones will just be able to connect to a low-orbit satellite and connect at 500 megabits per second. But not just that connection. Imagine that connection with ChatGPT built into the phone with all the knowledge that it has augmenting an eight-year-old out there in the rural townships. Imagine what's going to come from that. That is extraordinary, in my opinion. I don't think the next Twitter will come from here or the next Facebook. I think the next Twitter for water purification will. The next, you know, Facebook of agriculture will. I think that's going to be the unlock. So my advice is go ask your kids. They're using it already to cheat in their homework. Go ask the, you know, universities are struggling with this. Tertiary educational institutes, they're struggling with AI right now because the kids are all utilizing it. We utilize it all the time. I use it with my kids extensively. We talk to it. We ask it to quiz us at the dinner table. One phone is allowed to be on the table, and that's the phone that has ChatGPT running. That's ChatGPT, and we ask it. Anything that's a discussion, we ask it, what do you think? Is this true? We read this. I mean, it's part of our home now. We have someone. So I think it's going to go from that to you, Alec, having a complete digital twin. You'll be valued not on your individual identity. I think you're going to be valued on you and this digital derivative of you. And that combination will have extreme value to businesses in the future. So you'll be interviewed not based upon your CV and et cetera, et cetera. You'll be interviewed based upon you, et cetera, but also show us your digital twin and its capability and how you've trained it and what it knows and the two of you combined. I mean, the unlock's extraordinary. Think about the statistic. Most people in the enterprise today do work that's about gaining access to information. Most enterprise employees out there, 70% of the time, what they're doing is just finding information and collating that information. Now, imagine if we had an AI in an enterprise that could hyper-personalize a role or function in that enterprise. We would unlock 70% productivity. We would unlock 70% of human capability and let the machine go do that. And we can ideate and we can do things that waste time, which is ideation and creativity, and deliver a portfolio of services that we couldn't even have imagined. Now, I am speaking about it very flowery and positively. The challenge with AI is obviously bias. And I think the economic challenge with AI is you know, the Milton Friedman fitness function. You know, the sole responsibility of an organization is to derive value for its shareholders. That's what he gave us in the early 70s. The problem is you take that and you combine it with AI and you do get a dystopia where leadership are incentivized to do more with less. You know, that operating margin to create the jaws around that. So we do see wage stagnation. We do see businesses with extraordinary wealth on their balance sheets, but you see the amount of humanity starting to dip in their businesses. But that won't be because of AI and the machines. It will be because of leadership not having the ability to reimagine, right? And I think that's the burden on our shoulders because of AI right now from a leadership perspective, is not to do more with less, but do more of what was previously thought impossible. You know, and that's a human-machine symbiosis. Don't take machines to do the work and then lay all the labor force off. That's not necessary. The best derivative of AI is not it's not Blue that can beat Kasparov. It's a centaur. It's a grandmaster combined with an AI. You know, it's not a radiologist that gets outdone by Watson in terms of radiological X-ray information being done better. No, it's when a radiologist and the AI come together. We're seeing human-machine symbiosis as a very beautiful thing. So, you know, as enterprises, start playing with it. As individuals, your kids are already doing it. Most of us are using it anyway. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful unlock. But, you know, what it promises it's kind of what Bitcoin is bringing to the fore also. There's this economic freedom story, and then there's this economic unlock story. And these two things coming together, I'm very, very positive about it. And I'm very, very excited about the future.
Stafford Marcy, as always, a privilege. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.